Hello everyone, welcome to the show. Serial founder and the chief entrepreneur at Venture Rock, Mr. Mark Wesselink. Let's dive in. Mark Wesselink, thank you for being with us. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you for having me, Jean-Michel.
Good, our pleasure. So let's dive right in. Give us a little background, Mark, on who you are and what it is you do.
So I always present myself in a 10 second pitch, 12 and a half second. I'm a 12 time founder, failed four times, sold two companies. One company was listed on the stock exchange. Also had two bankruptcies, had the pleasure also to have cancer twice, learned to walk four times, thanks to 26 iterations. So I'm a startup, I think like a startup and I act like a startup.
Okay, that's definitely a lot to swallow. So you've had lots of very interesting experiences, definitely outside of business as well. Go back to the startup side. What is it that excites you so much about startups?
Do the impossible. So it's also connected to my personal history. When I was 15, they discovered a tumor in my spinal cord, and they said that I will never be able to walk again. Thanks to the technology and a lot of stamina, I'm still walking. Me and my mother especially, we found out the hard way that the systems are not only working for you, right? And so everybody says no, but you need to think yes, because if you keep thinking yes, you will make it happen eventually. And thanks to that persistence, I'm still driving around on a Segway, and sometimes sit in a wheelchair, but not definitely. And that's a little bit also how I keep on pushing the boundaries. And that's in essence also what you do as a startup. If you start a business, everybody will say to you, no, it's impossible. Nah, and when people say it's impossible, then my head starts spinning. So no, let's prove that it's impossible.
So you essentially grab the spark of determination that you learned in your sort of personal life, yep, and applied it to the business world. And why do you think that gives you an edge?
Because at the end, if you put your mind to it, you can make the impossible possible. As long as you really are listening to your surroundings, but also gather the inputs on what works and what doesn't work in very small mini steps, and in a continuously iteration, you will find something that will fit to a first possible solution, right? And not start thinking of it and paper and works and build 5 years to do so. No, the small iterations and the continuously learning path is what I like to do, and especially that's also the best way to make the impossible possible.
Okay, and as far as I understand, you've applied the majority of these lessons to the tech sphere, is that right? And if so, why tech?
So since 1999, so I started my first business in 1994, the second business in 1996, and it was two successful companies, but then started the third one and it failed. And it was during the internet boom in 1998, where we thought that the future of internet would be that you order a table of a restaurant online. And we were the only one who thinking that way, because the restaurant owners were looking at it like us. No, it's not going to happen. And so the third company, the fourth company, the fifth company, and sixth company were all online. But back in the days, that nobody was online except a few people. But technology for me was always a way to connect larger group of people, to cut out the middleman. because I'm a son of a small medium a business owner, and if you looked at what they were selling at what price because of all those middlemen, that was totally ridiculous. And I already saw back then that the internet would cut out the middlemen and create a much more fairer distribution of value instead of losing a lot of value in the go-betweens with traders or people that only stock boxes. And the only way to do so was technology. And technology can really benefit a large group of people. So that's why I jumped into technology full time.
Yeah, and the thing about Mateto specifically is it becomes quite difficult to sort of differentiate a winner from a loser, right? Like how do you go through this process? What runs through your head when you're thinking about this?
Yeah, so I always am focusing on creating the best potential solution, and that's always geared towards a win-win-win scenarios of all people involved. And if you and if you really dig down in the problems of all those parties in an ecosystem or in a supply chain, and really gearing towards solving problems for every individual slash company in that supply chain, then you are able to create a fantastic solution for all parties involved. And that's what is keeping me thinking that if you really add value in a supply chain, you also get a piece of the value. And that is, if you look at my history of starting businesses, that's always somewhere in there, on a first or a second level.
Okay, interesting. So you focus specifically on the value chain. So would that be like, would it be fair to say that usually a greedy business model is something that you don't typically like, and that seems sort of counterintuitive.
So I don't believe in greedy business models because that's a winner takes it all and a win lose lose model. And I think that's the past. I believe in the future, in a more fairer exchange of value and sharing of value. And my first online company was a company where you could book a table online. And the reason why I wanted to do that is to enable restaurant owners to get a total new audience of customers online. And although it failed, it struck me how they were looking at the internet in the wrong way. And nowadays, it's 90% of the restaurants are getting a restaurant reservation online, but not on a commission base, but purely on a SaaS fee. That's what I call a fair because if you, there are also sharks out there which are asking 20%, 25% commission on sales, and that's of course totally ridiculous.
Absolutely, and I mean to be fair, the model wasn't exactly terrible. I mean, right, OpenTable essentially owns this market in a vast majority of territory. So it's not like the model was flawed. But like you said, right, there are a few different businesses, at least in that industry, which charge ridiculous commissions, right? And it seems that businesses like these have been quite successful though in their time. Like, where do you think there's some kind of edge to a fair distribution of value, as it were?
Of course, one of the models that I was involved with was, of course, Just Eat. So the restaurant reservation system pivoted later into a company called Just Eat. We started in the Netherlands with Hapgids. It was a paperback with menu listings, printed, and we pivoted into hapgids.nl, and hapgids.nl became ByteGuide, and ByteGuide became Just Eat, and Just Eat is now one of the largest takeaway websites. We were really helping the restaurants in their business. So back in the days, we initiated, for instance, group buying of energy, group buying of packaging, group buying of insurance, scooter insurances. So the members of the community, they were able to lower their costs, and we get some sort of a kickback fee of all those revenue streams, and we charged between 5 and 6% commission on sales depending on the SaaS structure. And that those models, I kept thinking on, okay, how can you really create an inclusive model? And that also led me back in the days, 2006, to what I call a cooperative. If you create a cooperative, that the future ownership of Just Eat would be partly based on ownership of all the restaurant owners, so that you get like a cooperative framework for this. And then of course venture capital stepped in and sort of moved it all out, and it became what I call a shark, but eating everything, and that's not a win model. And I also was really interested in later, 10 years later, in the development of the DAOs, decentralized autonomous organization. And I once called on LinkedIn, what if Uber would be a DAO? Can you imagine how powerful that would be, right? And I believe that in the next centuries, the DAO or distributed ownership will be the future.
Yeah, so touching on a few different points you just mentioned. First of all, I think it was humble, I think, to sort of call that Open Table Business a bit of a failure, right? Because Just Eat is actually now one of the biggest companies in the space. But apart from that, on the DAO side, I really see an opportunity for DAOs to take over the gig economy as a whole. I think that's really probably where its first beachhead lies, right? Because there's so much abuse, essentially, of the participating members. Yep. How would you see that? Like obviously in an ideal world, how would you see that playing out? How would it come to life? Like, which would be the first country to adopt it? Obviously, I'm just asking you to sort of, you know, stick your finger up in here and look into the crystal ball, right?
Yeah, so it's sort of the gig economy, and it's interesting that you ask, but also suggest for the gig economy, because one of the now most important business models of the delivery companies out there is of course the gig economy, a biker driving around. And especially where I'm from in the Netherlands, there is also a labor law which states that if somebody works full time for you, he is an employee. A gig economy that doesn't work. But a lot of people out there they don't want to be an employee. They deliberately choose to be an independent professional. So how can you facilitate that? And I believe indeed that a DAO can facilitate that, because you're an owner of a DAO temporarily. If you deliver services through the DAO, then you're part of the DAO. But if you don't deliver services through the DAO, you're not part of the DAO anymore. And mind you, it's nothing new. 200 years ago, we created cooperatives, farmer cooperatives, but also finance cooperatives. One of the largest banks in the world is Crédit Agricole and Rabobank. They're all financial cooperatives, allocating members' money towards people that need the money. Farmer cooperatives, same story. But 200 years ago, we did not have the technology we have now. So they made like a total shit show out of it, because a farmers cooperative with 16,000 members, they now have a board, a an admin office. And so there, yeah, it's a shareholder structure, and the shareholder structure doesn't have anything with a cooperative thinking. And that's why I believe that the cooperative will frame the DAO in the future. And it's already proven that the model works. But now we need to initiate and replace the current shark models with cooperative DAOs.
Yeah, so I mean, a blockchain was essentially created to sort of eat banks, right? Maybe the reasons why DAOs haven't yet taken off is because and they haven't learned about the sort of legal lessons and the legal tricks and structures that these banks are using. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens when the DAOs of the world eventually wake up.
Yeah, and they will. They are already waking up. The state of Wyoming is the first state that enables DAO to incorporate according to the local legislation of Wyoming, and then actually own something. You have a legal structure, and I believe that in Europe the cooperative legal framework. We have a European cooperative, the Société Coopération Européenne, that is that can facilitate a DAO, and then if you add the ledger and the technology below it, that then it will really solve the problem, and not the current solutions out there.
Yeah. So this leads me to my next question. So, how do you use all of these lessons, and how did you sort of put them to good use with your role as chief entrepreneur at VentureRock?
So with VentureRock, so after my career as an entrepreneur, I started to help a lot of other entrepreneurs, and that later became a Startup Bootcamp, a business accelerator program. But I saw that a lot of companies are still failing because of interference of investors, venture capital, wrong hires, or whatever. So I really wanted to rethink the venture capital model, and that became VentureRock. And we mixed venture capital and venture building, and we put like a team on the path to solve a problem. And based on measurable progress, we increased the level of funding. And we do that now with a portfolio of 12 companies in total, and all the companies in our portfolio, they are geared towards how can we really leverage blockchain technology into solving real life problems. So one company is creating a platform where you have a fully transparent supply chain, so all the supply chain, the entire supply chain is connected with each other and even can leverage on each other's assets and have some sort of liquidity pool together. WeVestor, digital registration of ownership of a company through blockchain. Comply auditing on a blockchain, and we believe that blockchain, that the distributed ledger technology, can solve real problems instead of bumping each other's ego, but also fulfill the greed component, because the greed is always the first, but also the first that will diminish. And then people will see the real time and real life problems to solve. So hopefully we can go to the next level with blockchain, and then focus on problems instead of.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you mentioned blockchain and DLT specifically, not crypto, right? So we're clearly not talking about any sort of $25 million JPEGs. I think that's so far as clear. But I think one of the biggest issues with blockchain is that there's just so much ambiguity around sort of how it can solve today's problems. Now, I mean, the VC world, or the sort of venture capital world, is a very sort of particular sphere with its own issues and its own stumbling blocks, right? So how do you see blockchain solving problems in this space, and where's the value it can bring to the parties involved?
I think fractional ownership, that's one. So that means that fractional ownership is really easy to to store, but also to exchange. That's one. Two, creating transparency in in transparent or world, and especially when you look for now, we were working with a coffee chain, and a coffee chain is of course one of the most transparent supply chains. The farmers, they get like 1 or 2% of the total value chain. The traders, between 10 and 40% of the value chain, and then some sort of the added value resellers or packaging, the rest of the value chain. And I think that's of course not a fair distribution of value. So if you create a full transparency, then you can facilitate a much fairer exchange of value. And of course, the only way to do that is create a trusted middleman, and that's a DLT.
Yeah, so it's interesting how you sort of come back full circle, right? You've taken the lessons and the ideas which you've learned that sort of Just Eat and saying that, hey, listen, this is we should sort of charge some kind of commission because we're a business and we have to make money. But of course, too much doesn't do anything for anyone, and too little is just not a business that becomes charity, right? So it's interesting to see how you've applied this to sort of modern day problems. And on top of that, I think if this does eventually take off, I mean, if you're let's talk specifically about the coffee chain example, right? If you're divvying out more value to the farmer at the end of the day, and those farmers talk and that word spreads, and then why would they go anywhere else, right? Eventually.
So other people will take over this bottle. Because you attract the right coffee farmers, because they really feel that they are rewarded in a right way, but also need to help them get to a certain standard, right? And data plays a big role, and not data in one way, but data in specific ways. So you can let farmers make a picture of the crop. You can let farmers make pictures of the quality developing along the way, and all those data points you can use to maintain a certain level of quality without sending an auditor on a bi-weekly base or on a monthly or a yearly base that's controlling one single moment in instead of you leveling it in a continuously way. And you can do that through the entire supply chain. So you need to also think in a digital way in the supply chain. And nowadays, farmers are being sort of pushed in the corner. You can leave it here, thank you, and this is the price, and otherwise go somewhere else. And that's not the economy that I want.
So you have a very interesting perspective on investing in a blockchain. It almost sort of slightly resembles the Bitcoin white paper, at least from a morals perspective, right? And I think that's what was so interesting about Bitcoin. But the world seems to have a very different answer to that, right? Like everyone seems to be sort of worried about how they can make return and sort of where they can put their money in this next big project. And then inevitably there's hacks and there's rug pulls and there's everything under the sun that goes wrong,
but
right?
That's human behavior, right? If you look at the development of internet, internet became successful thanks to a few dodgy business models, right? But now it's adoption and it's more transparent. It will happen the same to blockchain. It's a human behavior that greeds. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll are the first, but then the Maslow pyramid will bring us to the top level, and then create where I really believe that the world needs. And that's a fair exchange of value, fairer distribution and exchange of value.
Mark, thank you so much for your time. This was an awesome conversation.
Thank you.
I'd love to have you back in the show sometime.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jean-Michel.